Perhaps most importantly, he was to meet his third and final mentor in the flesh, and not a moment too soon. Lucas had put Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces to good use between the third and fourth drafts of Star Wars, but it seemed at that point a rather utilitarian work and failed to light a spark in the young Lucas. It was not until some indeterminate point after the first movie, he said, that a friend gave him a series of Campbell lectures on tape. Lucas felt Campbell was much more powerful as a speaker than a writer. He described the experience of listening to the lecture as immediately electric and resolved to meet Campbell next time he was in town. Lucas had to wait until May 1983 before finally meeting the famed mythologist, who was almost 40 years his senior. Barbara McClintock, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist who was then in her 80s, was holding a symposium at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco, the inner reaches of outer space. Dune author Frank Herbert was in attendance, as was Apollo 9 astronaut Rusty Schweikart. But when Lucas called McClintock to ask for an introduction, it was not to any of these famed personalities. Rather, it was to Campbell, whose talk was the centerpiece of the symposium. Lucas, the space fantasist and mythology nerd, must have sat in the audience enraptured as Campbell described his concept of galactic space in soaring rhetoric, a universe of unimaginable magnitude and inconceivable violence, billions of roaring thermonuclear furnaces scattering from each other, many of them actually blowing themselves to pieces. The stars are at war. McClintock's introduction didn't go so well. Campbell and Lucas were seated next to each other, not speaking. Campbell had enjoyed silent movies back in the 1920s. He didn't really go for talkies and certainly didn't care for modern fare. He had a tendency to hold court, and Lucas was not the greatest at breaking the ice. So McClintock called over magician David Abrams, who did a trick that involved putting George's hand on Joe's. "That was it," McClintock recalled. Lucas and Campbell started talking about the impact of A Hero with a Thousand Faces on Lucas's movies, none of which Campbell had yet seen. They met next for dinner in Hawaii, where Campbell lived. "A friendship began to bloom," Lucas later told Campbell's official biographers. Campbell and his wife, Jean, came to stay with Lucas in his ever-widening San Anselmo estate for a week, and Lucas gently suggested showing him the Star Wars trilogy at Skywalker Ranch. "Would you be interested at all in seeing it? I can show you one or all three of them." Campbell opted for all three. Lucas suggested stretching them out over 3 days. Campbell insisted on doing the trilogy in a day. It marked the first time Lucasfilm had screened all three as a movie marathon. They took breaks for meals between each screening. When the credits rolled a third time, the 80-year-old Campbell sat in the dark and declared, "You know, I thought real art stopped with Picasso, Joyce, and Mann. Now I know it hasn't." That, McClintock noted, made Lucas's day. "I was really thrilled," Campbell said of the Star Wars series in a later interview. "The man understands the metaphor. I saw things that had been in my books but rendered in terms of the modern problem, which is man and machine. Is the machine going to be the servant of human life, or is it going to be master and dictate? That's what I think George Lucas brought forward. I admire what he's done immensely. That young man opened a vista and knew how to follow it, and it was totally fresh." Lucas returned Campbell's compliment in February 1985 at the National Arts Club, where Campbell was being presented with the Medal of Literature. In a potted revisionist history of his writing of Star Wars, Lucas gave a speech in which he said that prior to reading Campbell, he had been reading Freudians and Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge and all the other mythical heroes of our time. When he finally came across The Hero with a Thousand Faces, he said, it helped him carve a 500-page script down to 200 pages. "If I had not run across him," Lucas said, "I might still be writing Star Wars today." Of course, as we know, the script emerged more organically with a far greater range of mythic influences, such as the Golden Bough. Campbell's book arrived very late in the day, and the majority of the first movie's script was in place by the time Lucas read Hero. But Lucas was not about to let that fact get in the way of his burgeoning relationship with Campbell, one that reflected well on the saga in retrospect. "He is a really wonderful man, and he has become my Yoda," Lucas concluded. The following year, PBS broadcaster Bill Moyers, another mutual friend of Lucas and Campbell, told Lucas he was interested in filming multiple interviews with Campbell. "Bring him out to the ranch," Lucas insisted. "He would cover out-of-pocket expenses for the show. Just point the camera at him and turn it on. Let's not make a big deal of this. Let's just get him talking." The result, some 40 hours of interviews edited into a 5-episode special called The Power of Myth, hit screens shortly after Campbell passed away at the age of 83. The franchise that Campbell had inadvertently helped to shape, meanwhile, was not faring nearly as well. By 1985, the year George Lucas lionized Joseph Campbell at the National Arts Club, Star Wars was far from its mythical heights. The franchise seemed to be petering out as a brand for anyone but the youngest children, and even they were losing interest. There was a droids cartoon starring R2 and 3PO, which lasted for one season, and an Ewoks cartoon, which lasted for two. Initially, these cartoons were shown as a Star Wars Adventure Hour on ABC Saturday mornings, and a new line of Kenner figures and a Star Wars comic book were created to go with them. Viewership figures were great, in a few European and Latin American countries, that is. Not for the last time, Lucas turned to Disney to help revive the brand. The first Lucas-Disney collaboration was the Michael Jackson vehicle, Captain EO, executive produced by Lucas and directed by Coppola. That blossomed into a Star Tours theme park ride, which opened in Disneyland in January 1987. Disney CEO Michael Eisner helped Lucas open the proceedings with a lightsaber, a couple of droids, an Ewok or two, and a pair of large mice. Star Tours was situated at the same Tomorrowland that entranced a young Lucas back in 1955, and it had the singular honor of being the first Disney ride based on a non-Disney movie. Ironically, the concept for Star Tours was based on an idea for a ride related to Disney's Star Wars clone from 1979, The Black Hole. The total cost of what was to be the first version of Star Tours, $32 million, was twice the original cost of Disneyland itself and exactly the budget of Return of the Jedi. Outside of Disney parks, however, the whole Star Wars machine was creaking to a halt. The power in the toy world now resided with Mattel, which was still smarting from its failure to pick up the Star Wars license in 1976. Starting in 1981, Mattel did a reverse George Lucas. The company came up with the toy line first and then built a story around it. The toy was called He-Man. To create a story around the character, Mattel turned to Lucas's former friend, Don Glut. Working from Polaroids of the toys, Glut created the whole concept of Castle Grayskull, a mysterious location called Eternia. The result was called Masters of the Universe, and inferior as it was, it would steal a good deal of the Star Wars universe's thunder. Similarly, in 1982, the G.I. Joe franchise had been revived as a series of Star Wars-sized figures, together with a whole mythology, a Marvel comic, and a brand new enemy, the evil Cobra Force. Once again, it was the Star Wars playbook, but this time married to a muscular Reagan-era patriotism. G.I. Joe was Stallone's Rambo writ small. He-Man seemed more like Arnold Schwarzenegger writ small, with so much similarity that Mattel had to fight off a lawsuit brought by the owners of Conan the Barbarian. Kenner, which was still using the tagline, "Star Wars is forever," saw the writing on the wall as early as 1984. Sales of action figures had dropped off precipitously after Return of the Jedi. The movie had so much finality to it that there was nowhere left for kids to go. Darth Vader and the Emperor were definitively dead. What stories could you act out without the bad guys? An avid action figure director at the age of 10, I remember getting around this problem for a while by claiming the Emperor had been cloned, but got bored and packed my Star Wars figures away in the attic by the age of 12. Desperate to keep Star Wars alive, Kenner designer Mark Boudreau led a team effort to come up with a whole story that would follow on from Return of the Jedi, and they kitbashed some prototype action figures using spare parts. The concept was called The Epic Continues. The idea was that the Emperor's death had allowed a genetic terrorist called Atha Prime to return from the galactic exile he'd been banished to after the Clone Wars, bringing with him a whole bunch of clone warriors. Simultaneously, Grand Moff Tarkin was to return, revealing that he had somehow survived the destruction of the Death Star and led resurgent Imperial forces. And Luke and Han were to enlist the help of a bizarrely named new species from Tatooine called the Mongo Beefhead Tribesmen. Boudreau gave the presentation to Lucasfilm, fully aware that the future of Kenner could hang in the balance. Years later, he still vividly remembered Lucasfilm's response. They said, "Thank you very much. You guys have done an awesome job. But for now, we'd like to do some other awesome things." He wasn't to know that Lucas was jealously guarding his vision for the Clone Wars, or that in the perfectionist universe of the creator, there was no room for Mongo Beefhead Tribesmen. Kenner, Lucasfilm's longest-running licensee, shut down its Star Wars line in 1985, and General Mills spun the company off the same year. Marvel had been running into similar problems in its attempt to keep the Star Wars comic book relevant. The writers found a way to place Luke and friends in the throes of conflict with an alien invasion of the galaxy following the events of Return of the Jedi, but they could only keep that going for 3 years. The art looked tired, despite its attempts to keep up with the times. Luke Skywalker sported a mullet, a headband, and six-pack abs. After 9 years, the comic ceased publication with its 107th issue in May 1986. The newspaper comic strip had shut down 2 years earlier. In the mid-1980s, you were more likely to read about Star Wars in a political context than anything else. The popular moniker for President Reagan's new missile defense system was first used by the Democrats and intended as an insult, but the name stuck, and Reagan didn't correct it until after his re-election. For Lucas, a lifelong liberal, it was the ultimate irony, given the fact that the prime evil of the Star Wars galaxy had been based on the previous two-term Republican president. Lucas, as you may remember, wrote the original movie in the shadow of Vietnam and with Apocalypse Now buzzing around his brain. The Empire is granted the superior technology of the United States and a Nixonian leader we barely see. And the first draft of the script sees its space fortress brought down by creatures inspired by the Viet Cong. By the time those creatures make it onto the screen in Return of the Jedi, they have been deliberately disguised as cute teddy bears. The signs Lucas stuck up around ILM at the time, "Dare to be cute," suddenly take on new meaning. The Nixon character, Emperor Palpatine, is cloaked in the garb of a Sith. But did you notice something about the room in which we meet him on the second Death Star? As Lucas pointed out to Ian McDiarmid on set, Palpatine's office is oval. By the time the classic trilogy had wrapped up in 1983, Lucas's original intent had become so buried under layers of interpretation that Washington Post reviewer Gary Arnold praised his feel-good epic for helping to close some of the psychological wounds left by the war in Vietnam. Other reviewers at the time, and cultural critics since, have made the same mistake. "How clever of Lucas to put America in the underdog position," they said. Arnold was nearer the mark when he said that the franchise tapped into inspirational depths that transcend political allegiance. It reflected politically uncomplicated yearnings to be in the right, to fight on the side of justice against tyranny. No one knew this better than Reagan, who had been elected in the same year Empire won the box office. The question of whether a couple of uncomplicated feel-good California-made movies nudged voters toward this uncomplicated feel-good California-made movie actor candidate is one I'll leave to the psychologists, though the very idea would horrify the liberal Lucas. Reagan had described the Soviet Union as an evil empire in a speech before the National Association of Evangelicals in March 1983, a month after the first U.S. screening of Star Wars on HBO, and 2 months before the release of Return of the Jedi. The full quote is, "I urge you to beware the temptation of pride, the temptation of blithely declaring yourselves above it all and label both sides equally at fault, to ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire." Reagan's chief speechwriter, Anthony Dolan, says no Star Wars reference was intended. There have, after all, been one or two empires throughout history, evil or otherwise. What the world heard, however, was a reference to a fictional galactic empire. There was a similar situation later that month, when Reagan unveiled the concept of defensive systems that could intercept intercontinental missiles during a half-hour live TV address on the defense budget. He left the details hazy, probably because the notion of space satellite X-rays powered by nuclear explosions may have made the technology seem as incredulous as it in fact was. In terms of its feasibility, Reagan had been sold a bill of goods by Edward Teller, father of the H-bomb and the inspiration for Dr. Strangelove. The front page of the next day's Washington Post carried a rebuttal quote from the lion of the left, Senator Ted Kennedy, blasting Reagan's proposals as misleading Red Scare tactics and reckless Star Wars schemes. Perhaps realizing that a Star Wars scheme sounded a little too exciting to pin on his opponent, Kennedy threw a few other less appealing and more preposterous metaphors into a speech at Brown University in June. Reagan was proposing a supersonic Edsel, a lone ranger in the sky firing silver laser bullets and shooting missiles out of the hands of Soviet outlaws. But it was too late. The Star Wars nickname stuck. Cartoonists showed Reagan introducing his latest advisors, R2 and 3PO. Time magazine had a cover story about Reagan and defense in April. It was only the second occasion the words Star Wars had appeared on the cover of Time. The first was its cover on Empire. That vital review in 1977 had only said, "Inside, year's best movie." Reagan was suspiciously slow to defend his strategic defense initiative against the Star Wars comparison. He waited 2 years. It evidently didn't hurt him in the 1984 election, which he won in one of history's greatest landslides. Finally, in March 1985, the president gave a speech before the National Space Club. "The Strategic Defense Initiative has been labeled Star Wars," the president said, "but it isn't about war, it's about peace. And in that struggle, if you will pardon me stealing a film line, the force is with us." It was a masterful piece of political jujitsu on the great communicator's part. But, pedantically speaking, that wasn't the line Reagan was looking for. "The force is with us" was not used in a Star Wars movie until Attack of the Clones in 2002, when it was spoken by a Sith. Meanwhile, the Soviets were doing their best to pin the evil empire label back on the United States. The movies would not be shown in Russia until the 1990s, but the Washington bureau chief for TASS, the Soviet Union's centralized news agency, did his best to put a political spin on his Return of the Jedi review. "Darth Vader in America Now," said the reviewer, "is not only a cosmic brigand in an iron suit," an unnamed local journalist, he said, had pinned the same tag on President Reagan. "The magic mirror of Star Wars always reflected your enemies as the imperial evildoers." Lucasfilm took pressure groups on both sides of the political debate to court for using the words Star Wars in ads for and against the Strategic Defense Initiative. Its argument was that a real-life conflict damaged a franchise built entirely on imaginary warfare. The company ultimately lost the case, With the judge arguing that those two words were way too common in the English language for him to grant the plaintiff relief. "Star Wars, Your Honor, is a fantasy," complained Lucasfilm lawyer Lawrence Hefter. "It's something that doesn't exist." By the time he said that, it was starting to feel like the franchise didn't exist either. As the 10th anniversary of the original movie approached, there was little left of the franchise but nostalgia. The Star Wars fan club sent out its final issue of the Bantha Tracks newsletter in February 1987 and promptly shut down. Dan Madsen, the kid from Colorado who had replaced his Star Trek posters with Star Wars posters in 1977, was now running the Star Trek fan club. Lucasfilm contacted him in early 1987, brought him out to Skywalker Ranch, and asked him if he would also run the successor to the Star Wars fan club. It was to be called the Lucasfilm Fan Club, and it would focus on non-Star Wars movies on the Lucasfilm docket. "I definitely got the feeling he was trying to step away from Star Wars," Madsen said. "It was hard to be a Star Wars fan at that moment." Disappointed, he nevertheless accepted the offer. "I just had fun covering the other movies and bided my time." Starlog magazine, at least, couldn't let the 10th anniversary of the first Star Wars release pass without commemoration. That May, it threw a convention at a hotel near LAX. 10,000 fans showed up. George Lucas was the guest of honor and gave a speech after being presented by R2-D2 and C-3PO with a giant birthday card signed by thousands of fans. "He was surprised by how much Star Wars had taken off," he said, "and someday, no promises, he hoped to get back to it." That got a loud cheer. Then there was a surprise Madsen had helped arrange. Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, bounded onto the stage. Lucas wasn't one for surprises, and looked shocked. Roddenberry, a big bear hugger of a guy, enthusiastically grasped the arm of the quiet, reserved Lucas, who was about a foot smaller. It was the one and only time these giants of the geek world were to meet. Madsen was the only one who thought to snap a picture. Also speaking at this first tentative Star Wars convention was Howard Rothman, the new vice president of Lucas Licensing. Rothman, an ambitious and accomplished young lawyer, had joined the company in 1980 at age 27, the week Empire Strikes Back came out. He was quickly promoted to general counsel. In 1987, he had been given the seemingly impossible task of fighting the power of He-Man and G.I. Joe. Could Star Wars toys be revived without any Kenner-like plan for new stories? "It was not a great time to get that job," Rothman remembered in 2010. "But I thought, I'll show them. I'll be the greatest salesman who ever lived. I went out to every retailer, every licensee, trying to convince them to restock Star Wars, and to a one, they told me, 'Kid,' I did look like a kid back then, 'Star Wars is dead.' I had to go back to George Lucas and deliver the news. That was a meeting I wasn't looking forward to. I thought it was going to be a situation where he presses a button and your chair falls through the floor into a tank of piranhas. I'll never forget it. He looked at me and narrowed his eyes and said, 'No. It's not dead. It's just taking a rest. A lot of kids really love those movies. Someday, they're going to grow up and have kids of their own. We can bring it back then.' That was the moment I realized that George Lucas really is Yoda." Meantime, Rothman and Lucasfilm focused their attention on other brands. The company had a couple of notable failures in 1986 with Howard the Duck and Labyrinth, both produced by Lucas, and directed by Lucas' friends Willard Hike and Jim Henson, respectively. But Lucasfilm had high hopes for its movies in production, a fantasy called Willow, starring Warwick Davis, who had played the lead Ewok, Wicket, in Return of the Jedi, a Coppola biopic of automaker Preston Tucker, and the third Indiana Jones film. There was also Lucasfilm Games, a profitable new division that was later renamed LucasArts. It produced a string of hits such as Maniac Mansion, an adventure video game with a TV show tie-in, and had many more titles in the works. Ironically, The one thing the games division couldn't produce at the time was Star Wars games, for which Atari, and later JVC, held the license. There was one form of Star Wars game that Rothman's team was able to license, however, and it was the geekiest version of them all. The Star Wars role-playing game, made by a tiny company in Pennsylvania called West End Games, launched in October 1987. For the next 3 years, it would be about the only thing going on in the Star Wars universe. Those Dungeons and Dragons players who switched to playing Star Wars would be like the Irish monks who saved civilization by copying ancient scrolls through the Dark Ages. It's an apt metaphor, since the role-playing game wasn't just preserving the memory of Star Wars. It was cataloging and enhancing it. To create the source book for all those dungeon masters out there, West End Games director Bill Slavicek had to invent names for all the alien races, all the ships, all the weapons and droids. He had to figure out the nuts and bolts of how Lucas's universe worked and fill in all the gaps that the creator hadn't bothered to think about. At the time, it seemed about the nerdiest thing you could possibly do. But Slavicek's work, and the contributions of writers who came after him, would prove incalculably important to the coming Star Wars revival. 19. The Universe Expands. The Expanded Universe, it was called. And what a universe it was! Some 260 novels, dozens of short stories, 180 video games, more than 1,000 comic books, more than 120 book authors alone who got to contribute their own little piece to Star Wars legend. So much creativity, and according to the internal rules of Star Wars canon, any bit of it could be overwritten by Lucasfilm's on-screen work at any time. Indeed, Episode 7 has already banished the expanded universe to the universe next door. Like so much of Star Wars, the expanded universe was dominated by activity in the 1990s and 2000s. But it actually got its start in 1976, earlier than the original movie, courtesy of Alan Dean Foster. The world wouldn't see the result of his labors until February 1978, but the Ghost Rider's Star Wars contract demanded a second book. So once he'd spent 2 months writing up the original Star Wars novelization and mailed it off to Lucas's lawyer, Tom Pollock, Foster turned right back to his IBM Selectric typewriter, loaded another piece of blank paper into it, and started work on the first ever Star Wars tale not created by George Lucas. No biggie. Before the world even knew who Luke and Leia were, then Foster packed them off to the fog-shrouded, cave-filled planet of Mimban. It was fog-shrouded and cave-filled because one of the few directions Lucas had given was to write something cheap. The novel was little more than an insurance policy. If Star Wars only broke even, or made just a tiny bit of profit, he could use Foster's book as the basis for a screenplay and make a quick sequel on a Roger Corman budget while the sets were still lying around. When Foster wrote a thrilling battle in space for Chapter 1, Lucas nixed it. No doubt the massive cost overrun at ILM was weighing heavy on his mind. In the potential future of the cheap Star Wars sequel, there'd be no more Dykstra-driven headaches. Make it work as a Sergio Leone Western, Lucas suggested to Foster in one of their two meetings to discuss the book. It can go more into the middle of nowhere where these really slimy creatures live. Essentially, space can be boring. Now that we've established the space fantasy, we can move away from that. The book Foster produced was called Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and it was shaped by more constraints than just Lucas's presumed budget. Only Luke and Leia were in the book, because Harrison Ford was not signed up for a sequel. Only Vader's face was on the Ralph McQuarrie cover, with Luke and Leia seen from behind, because Lucas did not at that point have the rights to use Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher's faces. The plot was a movie Foster constructed in his head out of spare parts Lucas had left lying around. Luke and Leia met Hala, a Force-sensitive old woman, and go off in search of the Force-enhancing Kyber crystal. something Lucas discarded after the third draft of Star Wars, as he felt it turned the Jedi into hard-to-root-for superhumans. Darth Vader, alerted to their presence, meets them there. He and Luke have their first lightsaber showdown, but not before Leia has taken Vader on with a lightsaber herself. In an odd reversal of what would come to pass in Empire, Luke slices Vader's arm off. Vader falls down a deep cave shaft. At the end, though, Luke senses Vader is still alive. Foster was simply having fun. Few elements of Star Wars were sacrosanct at this point, least of all Vader and his tragic arc. Surprisingly, Lucas declared in those 1976 conversations with Foster that Vader was a weak villain, that the killing of Obi-Wan Kenobi aside, he never does anything to anybody. I mean, he chokes one guy. He would have to be built up as a villain in this second book, Lucas declared, and Luke kills Vader in the end. Luckily, Lucas's word was hardly law at this stage. Foster effectively saved Vader's life. As hokey as its plot was, Splinter was another bestseller. By the time it was published in February 1978, 9 months after the first film's release, the world was hungry for any new Star Wars story. Children would reread the paperback until it fell apart in their hands. Foster was offered more Star Wars novel deals by Del Rey. The story of Chewbacca's second cousin's uncle, that kind of thing, he recalls, but declined. It was time to move on. Apart from Splinter, there were surprisingly few Star Wars novels during the original trilogy years. Those two scoundrels, Han Solo and Lando Calrissian, got pulpish paperback trilogies of their own. Han got exciting Western-style adventures at the outpost called Star's End. Lando got odd, almost psychedelic adventures with the mind harp of Sharu. Before she died, Lee Brackett was signed up to write a Princess Leia novel. She was not replaced, and once again, Leia would get short shrift. The expanded universe was left to Marvel Comics, which produced characters that would sometimes irk Lucasfilm, the most infamous being one of the earliest, a wise-cracking green cartoon rabbit called Jackson, modeled on Bugs Bunny. Jackson offered the first inkling of the disastrously off-based concepts and creations that could swirl out of the expanded universe. But for every Jackson, fortunately, there was a Mara Jade, or a Grand Admiral Thrawn. One afternoon in the fall of 1988, Lou Aronica came back from lunch in Midtown Manhattan, shut his office door, and wrote an impassioned letter to George Lucas. His lunch buddy had told him he'd read someplace that Lucas had officially announced there were going to be no more Star Wars movies. "There's just so much wrong with that," thought Aronica. The rebel victory at the end of Return of the Jedi had seemed tenuous at best. He was a Luke Skywalker guy. What happened next to the galaxy's only trained Jedi? "This body of work is too important to popular culture to end with these three movies," Aronica wrote. Aronica wasn't just an aggrieved fan. He was the head of mass market publishing at Bantam and had founded the company's popular science fiction imprint, Spectra. His pitch to Lucas: "If you're not doing anything more with the franchise, let us produce quality books under your supervision." Aronica didn't want to churn out two so-so novels every month the way the Star Trek franchise did. He envisioned one well-written hardback a year, starting with a trilogy that advanced the whole Star Wars story, written by an award-winning author. "We can't do these casually," he recalls saying at the time. "They have to be as ambitious as the movies were." Aronica heard nothing back for nearly a year. At some point, Lucas licensing VP Howard Rothman went to sound Lucas out about the idea. "No one is going to buy this," said Lucas, but gave his assent anyway. Ground rules were laid down. The first novel would take place 5 years after Return of the Jedi. Events prior to the original movie, such as the Clone Wars, were untouchable. Lucas was mulling the possibilities of prequels and didn't want anything to interfere with his creative process. No major characters could be killed off, and no one who was already dead in the movies could be brought back. Aronica agreed, gleefully. He cast around for writers, but didn't have to look too far. Spectra had just signed up Timothy Zahn, a Hugo Award-winning author who had written the Cobra trilogy, a tale of intergalactic war. Aronica called up Zahn's agent and learned that the author was an even bigger Star Wars fan than Aronica was. When Zahn turned in his manuscript, it was Aronica who came up with the title, Heir to the Empire. Zahn's novel was released on May 1, 1991. Lucasfilm lore claims that it was as instant a hit as the first Star Wars movie. I'll never forget the day that Lucy Autry Wilson, Lucasfilm finance director, came into my office in 1991 to deliver the news that Tim's Heir to the Empire had premiered at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, Rothman wrote in the introduction to the 20th anniversary edition of the book. In fact, Heir was on a slower boil than that. The book first appeared on the Times bestseller list on May 26, debuting at number 11. The next week, it reached number 6, leapfrogging James Michener's The Novel. Another 2 weeks, and it overtook John Grisham's debut, The Firm, reaching the number 2 spot, held back by Dr. Seuss's Oh, the Places You'll Go, the only cheaper hardback on the list than Air, which was priced at a deliberately low $15. On June 30, 1991, 2 months after it was released, Heir to the Empire became a coveted New York Times hardcover fiction list number one bestseller. It remained at the top for exactly 1 week, though it stayed on the overall list for a total of 19 weeks. Its initial print run of 70,000 copies was gone within months. 4 more print runs followed that year. Not bad at all, but you'd need a pretty selective memory to remember it debuting at number one. Aronica is aggrieved by another claim Rothman makes in his introduction, that it was Lucy Autry Wilson who came up with the idea of pitching publishers rather than the other way around, and that Bantam just happened to be the only publisher that believed in the idea. They didn't approach us. They responded to my letter, Aronica says. I knew a lot of other people in the science fiction publishing world, and they were all furious that I'd been able to make this deal. After having to convince his bosses that Star Wars could sustain one hardback a year, Aronica now found himself having to hold back a deluge of books. There was a lot of money to be made, he says. The program grew out a little faster than I would have liked. After Zahn completed his trilogy, there were 6, then 9, then 12 books a year. 1997 saw a record 22 Star Wars novels for all reading ages. The quality and sales suffered accordingly. There was no year between the 1991 release of Air and 2013 in which we have seen fewer than 10 Star Wars novels. They sometimes nudge the bottom of the bestseller list for a week or so, like Star Trek paperbacks. Zahn's most recent Star Wars novel, Scoundrels, sold a respectable 17,000 copies, but it's a far cry from Aronica's version of one movie-like event book a year, or from the sales of Air, which has been purchased more than 1 million times and which still moves about 5,000 copies a month. We could have made Star Wars a best-selling author, like a Grisham or a Clancy, and retained the audience, Aronica laments. If every book was as good as Air, maybe they'd be top 5 bestsellers every time out. So what was it that made Air so good? It was a case of making new Star Wars by loving the idea and hating many of the preceding details. Timothy Zahn was a huge Star Wars fan, and had been since 1977, when he was a physics student in grad school and took no fewer than 8 separate dates to see the movie. I was a physicist, he says. They had to know what they were getting into. He had listened to Star Wars soundtracks while writing every prior science fiction novel, but as with any true Star Wars fan, there was something that bugged him. He didn't like the fact that the Jedi seemed to have no inherent limit on their ability to operate the Force other than their own belief in it. If they can do anything, he says, they're just superheroes. So when Zahn was pacing around his house in November 1989, in those first few days after getting the call from his agent about Aronica's offer, excited about the chance to play in the Star Wars sandbox and nervous about the notion of failing spectacularly in front of the hardcore fans, this was his first vision. A cage constructed of creatures that could negate the effects of the Force. A cage fit for a Jedi. Zahn is fond of modestly insisting he didn't revive Star Wars fandom. The fans were there, he says, ready for anything that said Star Wars on its cover. I got to stick my fork in the pie crust and show how much steam there was underneath, he says. But he also made key choices about the directions the universe would expand in, choices that would lay down a template for what worked in Star Wars literature. Zahn would also be reminded of what didn't work when he made the apparently innocent choice to have Luke drink a cup of hot chocolate in the early pages of Heir to the Empire. Fans howled with protest at this Alan Dean Foster-like insertion of a very earthbound beverage. Anyone faced with the task of picking out the threads Lucas had tied up at the end of Return of the Jedi would have been presented with some major problems. Lucas had killed off the series' two main villains, the Emperor and Darth Vader. The Empire was on the run. It needed a seriously good bad guy at its helm to keep readers' interest. With the Rebellion ascendant, here was a chance to create a villain who was also an underdog. One who, unlike his predecessors, ruled by loyalty rather than fear. So Zahn came up with the character of Grand Admiral Thrawn, a blue-skinned, red-eyed humanoid who had worked his way up Imperial ranks, a brilliant tactician who studied the art of any species he was in conflict with in order to understand their culture and thus outsmart them. A guy like that could uncover those obscure, force-negating, anti-Jedi creatures that Zahn decided to call Silamari. Zahn did not always follow Lucas's habit of writing easily pronounceable names. With that, Zahn was off to the races. He had a notion for a dark Jedi with whom Thrawn could make common cause. He would be an insane clone of Obi-Wan Kenobi, created in the Clone Wars. Who better to throw Luke for a loop? He wanted to investigate the Sith, since Vader was always being called the Dark Lord of the Sith, and nobody knew what the Sith were. Zahn imagined a race of diminutive assassin aliens with faces that looked like Vader's mask. He wanted a wily smuggler in the Han Solo vein, but one who was operating on a larger scale and could be even more wily. Along came Talon Card, supplier of ships that the Rebels were in desperately short supply of, and his ship, the Wild Card. And then there was Mara Jade, whom Zahn created specifically to fix something he hated about Return of the Jedi. His main problem with the film? The opening act in Jabba's palace seemed disjointed from the rest of the movie. What did any of that have to do with the struggle against the Empire? The topic of the entire trilogy. So Zahn retroactively inserted an Imperial assassin into Jabba's palace who tried, but failed, to ensure Skywalker's death off-screen. The assassin worked directly for the Emperor, whom, Zahn decided, no longer trusted Vader's plan to turn his son to the dark side. Mara Jade, the Emperor's hand, would put Luke in jeopardy throughout his trilogy. She was to become, after Thrawn, the expanded universe's most popular character. She would marry Luke Skywalker in a later book, even though that's not what Zahn originally intended. She would inspire the first online mailing group, and later the first blog, to cover the expanded universe, Club Jade. With her vibrant red hair, green eyes, and full-figured leather jumpsuit, Mara is fast becoming one of the more popular Star Wars costume choices for women on the comic convention circuit. She offers all of the feisty, fiery personality that Leia should have developed, but ultimately lacked. Zahn had all of these concepts and characters in place in a mere 2 weeks and turned in a rough outline before Lucasfilm and Bantam had even inked a contract. The first draft of Heir to the Empire was written in 6 months. Then came the pushback. Lucasfilm wouldn't let him clone Obi-Wan Kenobi. That flouted the ban on avoiding the Clone Wars and resurrecting old characters. The race of assassins could not be called the Sith. Zahn had come up with his own laws of physics, his own background Bible to the universe. Lucasfilm wanted him to use the source book from West End Games' Star Wars role-playing game. Zahn chafed against what seemed like arbitrary restrictions. This was 1990. The Star Wars universe was still ill-defined. There was no internal digital database of its components at Lucasfilm yet, and certainly no fan-edited encyclopedia yet. Zahn chafed further when he found out that Lucasfilm was simultaneously restarting the Star Wars comics line with a publisher called Dark Horse and wanted Zahn to coordinate his efforts with them. The comic series, Dark Empire, was to show Luke confronting a clone of the Emperor. For Zahn, that was a clone too far. "It destroys Darth Vader's sacrifice in killing the Emperor at the end of Return of the Jedi," he says. "It unravels the whole original trilogy." Compromises were reached. The insane clone of Kenobi, which Zahn fought the hardest for, became a dark Jedi called Joris Sebowoth. The Vader-worshipping assassins became the Nogri. Zahn's ideas for the book title, Wild Card and Emperor's Hand, were nixed by Aronica. Heir to the Empire it was. But Zahn wasn't done hating Dark Empire, even though the comics referenced Grand Admiral Thrawn in their introductions. In a later novel, Visions of the Future, Zahn had Mara Jade and Luke recall having dealt with a cloned Emperor. "Whatever," says Mara. "I'm not even convinced that was him." To its credit, Dark Empire is the source for the notion of a repository of Jedi knowledge, a holocron, which would play an important role in the expanded universe in years to come. These days, having seen the Clone Wars unfold, Zahn is grateful that Lucasfilm fought back. There are still things he chafes against, one of them being the fact that a later writer, spoiler alert, killed off Mara Jade in a duel after infecting her with mysterious intergalactic spores. "It would have been nice to let me know and to let me argue why not," he said. "I know that Lucasfilm owns everything I put down on paper and give them, but it still feels like losing your daughter." The Expanded Universe fans at Club Jade were right there with him. "They shunt her to the side and give her a stupid disease," complains Tracy Duncan, a Detroit journalist known to the internet as Dunk, proprietor of the Club Jade blog. "It was like, oh, we only have two or three female characters. Let's kill off one of them. Such a waste." The Expanded Universe may have been two steps below the movie canon at all times, then erased from the canon altogether. But having authors and a story and characters messed with could hurt as much for fans as it had once hurt for Lucas. Shelley Shapiro likes to say she saved Han Solo's life. Bantam Del Rey, where Shapiro is an editor, took over the Lucasfilm publishing license from Spectra in 1998, part of a deal connected to the forthcoming release of the prequel movies. Lucasfilm had wanted the expanded universe to slowly build up a vast and complex mythology, but the plan had worked too well and too fast. The novels had already gotten too sprawling, the quality uneven. One trilogy follows Luke Skywalker as he sets up a Jedi Academy in the mysterious ruins of Yavin, the jungle planet seen at the end of Star Wars, which turns out to be haunted. Han and Leia get married, and a book devotes itself to the backstory of the wedding. Derided as one of the worst novels of the expanded universe, the courtship of Princess Leia sees Han kidnap and control his future wife with the laughably titled Gun of Command after she receives a marriage offer from a well-connected prince. Tracy Duncan's suitably snarky commentary on the plot of courtship: "He doesn't need a gun of command. He's Han Solo." The Solos then have three kids: Jaina, Jason, and Anakin. Bring on the Young Jedi Knight series! Lucasfilm called a summit at Skywalker Ranch, at which Shapiro was thrown straight into the deep end of the Star Wars universe. She, her first three authors, and a contingent from Dark Horse Comics were there to discuss what became known as the New Jedi Order, a series that would send the expanded universe off in a new direction over the course of 29 novels, a number later whittled down to 19. There was to be an alien species invading the galaxy. The concept suggested by Kenner and used by Marvel Comics was to be given a fresh coat of paint. But to inject a sense of jeopardy and gravitas into a universe where Luke and the Jedi had, despite Zahn's best efforts, become way too much like superheroes once again, the licensees would also dust off the idea proposed by Lawrence Kasdan during that Return of the Jedi story conference. A main character must die. Lucas had evidently moved on from the days when he felt that it wasn't nice to kill our favorite characters. "Early on, we got the all clear to kill anyone," says Mike Stackpole, an author at the table. "Literally, anyone was fair game." Shapiro, a serious Harrison Ford fan, says she put her foot down. Han Solo would live. Stackpole remembers it differently. He says there was a simple, methodical process of deciding which of the leads, Han, Luke, Leia, Lando, the droids, Chewbacca, it would hurt the least to lose. From whose viewpoint would it be hardest to describe the grief? "After 2 days," Stackpole says, "we had Chewie locked down." When fan grief over the death of Chewbacca surpassed anything Shapiro or Stackpole expected, a rumor surfaced that Randy Stradley of Dark Horse Comics had told the meeting to kill the family dog and compared Chewie to Old Yeller, but Stackpole denies that, insisting they all stuck the knives in at the same time, like Roman conspirators. Shapiro, who would edit the book, was happy to wield a blade. "You've got to get people's attention. Otherwise, it's just, oh, another adventure, another super weapon," Shapiro explains. Vector Prime, the first novel of the New Jedi Order, would thus become the most controversial work in the history of the expanded universe, whose readers like to protest even more loudly than the average Star Wars fan. The author of Vector Prime, R.A. Salvatore, would receive death threats for his contribution to the oeuvre. He was, however, only obeying orders, and did at least give the Wookiee a heroic end. Chewie is killed, helping to evacuate the population of a planet whose moon, thanks to the alien invaders, has fallen out of orbit. Financially, it was successful, and it did work, Shapiro says. Even people who complained about it couldn't put it down. But for fans who still mourn Chewie to this day, there is one more figure to blame, a man largely unseen at the summit. As with all major decisions in the expanded universe, the ultimate go-ahead was granted via one of those lists of yes-slash-no checkboxes that Howard Rothman was constantly presenting to his boss, and you can't imagine this one would have just breezed past him. The decision to kill Chewbacca, the character based on the Lucas's dog Indiana, resides with George Lucas. Years later, Stackpole apologized to Peter Mayhew, Chewbacca actor. Mayhew smiled and shrugged. "It doesn't matter. Chewie lives on in the movies." Years after that, when the expanded universe collapsed and Episode 7 wiped over Vector Prime's continuity, it turned out Mayhew was right. Chewie lives on, thanks to new movies. In 2002, Alan Dean Foster was ready to return to the universe he'd helped birth. He had been offered a contract for a book called The Approaching Storm. After he wrote his first draft at his usual speed, Foster was offered significantly more guidance from Lucasfilm than his previous "take out the first chapter, it's too expensive" experience. He spent days at Skywalker Ranch with an entire committee that went over the manuscript point by point and disagreed with his characters and their motivations. It was guidance in the sense that you're in a Catholic school and nuns walk by with rulers, Foster remembered. It was no fun. Things had changed by the time Foster returned. The freewheeling levity of the late 1970s had vanished. The self-spoofing spirit of Jackson the Bunny had been replaced, even in the comics, with gravely serious melodrama. Only one comic book's title, the much-loved Star Wars Tales, managed to avoid the nuns with their rulers, and that was because it explicitly stated in each issue that its stories were not to be considered canon. Fans still fondly remembered its pastiches of The Breakfast Club with Star Wars characters, or its what-if tale in which Han Solo travels to Earth through a freak wormhole. His skeleton is discovered years later by Indiana Jones. When Star Wars Tales switched to all serious stories, readership fell off a cliff, and the title promptly shut down. The franchise had entered a whole new phase, and it would lead Lucasfilm to exert ever greater control as it struggled to accommodate a difficult new story from the creator. The outrage from those cranky, critical expanded universe fans over the deaths of Chewbacca and Mara Jade was as nothing compared to the criticism that came in the wake of new additions to Star Wars canon. Midi-chlorians, Gungans, and a very strange virgin birth. 20. Return of the Writer. According to Lucasfilm legend, the prequels began in the early morning of November 1, 1994. In plaid shirt, jeans, and white sneakers, George Lucas walked up the wooden stairs to his writing tower, to the door desks, to the franchise he had unceremoniously abandoned 11 years earlier. This time, he'd brought a camera operator to record the moment. The results would be edited and shown on a brand new medium, the World Wide Web. "My oldest daughter was sick all night," Lucas confided. "I got no sleep whatsoever." He walked past the fireplace, the couch, the side table with the Tiffany lamp. On mornings when the fog has already poured over Mount Tam, one could imagine Lucas lighting a fire and ruminating. It was the first time Lucas had shown fans the cave I hibernate in, as he called it. He walked over to his door desks, little changed from the days when he struggled over early drafts of the Star Wars. "I have beautiful, pristine yellow tablets," he said, picking up his long-standing paper of choice. He opened a drawer, a nice, fresh box of pencils. The camera captured his tired face, the bags under his eyes. "All I need," he said, collapsing dramatically into his chair, "is an idea." It seemed part exhaustion, part playing to the camera. This was how Episode 1 began. Bathed in absolute self-awareness that history was being made. The previous year, a few months after the release of Jurassic Park, Lucas had summoned a writer from Variety to Skywalker Ranch to inform the world that he had made the decision. Work was to begin on the prequel movies, episodes 1 through 3. At that stage, he planned to shoot them all together. Every luxury Lucas had been denied in the making of the original film, luxury of time, of budget, of technology, was his for the taking. How could the prequels not succeed? The only person who doubted George Lucas as he pulled out the fabled three-ring binders with his notes on the Star Wars universe was George Lucas himself. He was to remain pessimistic throughout the production process. "For every person who loves Episode 1, there will be 2 or 3 who hate it," he predicted at its end. "You just never know with these things," Lucas remarked one day during filming to Yoda puppeteer Frank Oz. "I made more American Graffiti. It made 10 cents. "Really?" said Oz. "It just failed miserably." Oz and Lucas looked at each other for a beat. "You can do it," continued Lucas. "You can destroy these things. It is possible." So why not leave well enough alone? Why not simply allow Star Wars to chug along in expanded universe form, in games and books and comics? Lucas had allowed adventures to take place after Return of the Jedi, and he could just as easily explore the prequel world that way too. Why risk being the destroyer of Star Wars, as well as its creator? And why start then, that day, November 1, 1994? A confluence of forces had brought the creator back to his creation in the early 1990s. The technology was finally where he wanted it to be, using puppets, models, actors in rubber suits, and the less jerky stop-motion animation, even go-motion, the version pioneered by Phil Lippett, had always been painful stopgap solutions for Lucas. They were constrictions on his imagination more than they were expressions of it. You might have enjoyed the rubber puppet fest of Jabba's palace, but it made the creator wince. Computer animation, however, Lucas had known that was the future since he first tentatively used it in 1977 in the Rebel pilot's briefing room. ILM was making the future happen right under his nose. Advances in computer-generated imagery, or CGI, were coming thick and fast. The company used a computer program to remove wires from a few scenes in Howard the Duck in 1985. Then a young digital animator Lucas hired, John Lasseter, produced a stunning 3D rendering for the movie Young Sherlock Holmes, in which a knight in a stained glass window comes to life and attacks a priest. The scene still holds up today. Many of ILM's experiments were less flashy, almost Easter egg-like, such as a plane scene in the sky for a few seconds of Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun, 1984.